Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me, as always, is Mike Montgomery.
And the mystery of tonight's episode is basically, how did I not go back to watching this movie sooner?
Damn right. Yes, we are solving the ultimate crime. We are ditching movies. This is now a crime podcast. And the first case, the unsolved case, in my opinion, ignore the ending of this movie. It's unsolved. It's unsolved. We'll get to it. We have sponsorships to make.
Well, hey, true crime shows seem to be where the money is.
Right? This is the ultra dark, super noir detective pulp goodness of Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Mommy's going to the beauty parlor, darling. But I'm leaving you with your favorite friend, Roger. He's going to take very, very good care of you. Because if he doesn't, he's going back to the science lab.
Cut, 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 cut!
What the hell was wrong with that take?
Nothing with you, baby Herman. You were great. You were perfect. You were better than perfect. Just Roger. He keeps blowing his lines.
Roger.
What's this?
A tweeting bird.
Tweeting bird. Roger, read the script. Look what it says. It says rabbit gets clunked. Rabbit sees stars. Not birds.
Stars!
Can we lose the playback, please? You're killing me. Killing me.
For crying out loud, Roger. How many times do we have to do this damn scene? Raoul, I'll be in my trailer. Taking a nap.
Excuse me,
please,
Cuts.
Raoul. I can give you stars. Just drop the refrigerator in my head one more time.
Roger, I kept on your head 23 times already.
I can take it. Don't worry about me.
I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about the refrigerator.
This is the tale of an up-and-coming movie star named Roger Rabbit and a down-and-out private detective.
Stay out!
Named Eddie Valiant.
Ooga booga.
Every moment they were together was a new adventure in trouble.
Hide me, Eddie. Please.
It's a motion picture about friendship.
Get easy, Billy! Please, Eddie! Don't tell me I'm making a big mistake!
Love. Compassion.
All right, I'm sorry I yanked your ears.
All the time you yanked my ears?
Murder.
Marvin Acme. The rabbit cacked him last night.
Remember, you never saw me.
Sex.
I'd do anything for my husband, Mr. Valiant. Anything.
And violence.
Tunes gets him every time.
You wouldn't have any idea where the rabbit might be.
Got a thing for rabbits, huh?
The whole thing stinks like yesterday's diapers.
It's a comedy a little different from all the rest.
I'm a pig!
I'm a toon!
I'm not bad. I'm just drawn that way.
But tell me, Eddie. Is that a rabbit in your pocket, or you just happy to see me?
Touchstone Pictures and Steven Spielberg present a Robert Zemeckis film.
We toons may act idiotic, but we're not stupid.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
And folks, I know you probably have questions hearing that description about Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but I'm sorry. As someone who has a fairly large collection of radio plays with like Dashiell Hammett's Sam Spade, Raymond Chandler's Philip Marlowe, like those actual like 40s detective shows, every word she just said is perfectly accurate.
Oh yeah, this is a love letter to an entire genre and era of pulp novels, radio broadcasts, movie serials, and very serious and well-remembered noir films starring some of Hollywood's greatest. This is, of course, you know, Hollywood is always at its best when it's praising itself. Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Sure. And this, in my opinion, has always stood out as one of the greatest achievements of the Walt Disney Company. It's not just on a technical level. It's such a competent film. It stands up so well, even decades later, and with like even hand-drawn animation techniques having been evolved far past this, even in its own time. I mean, like, this came out in the same year or so, I want to say 16 months, as Akira. And it's like, some of the characters in this are very loose. And Akira stays, remains like crisp and clear and like, holy fucking shit. Whereas the larger and more high definition your screen gets, the more this is going to start looking like, oh, cool, motion blobs. I love motion blobs.
Well, and also, like, when she says hand-drawn, we're talking the animation portions, those cells were literally drawn on top of stills from the live action and then put together the hard way.
Yeah. So, all right. Wait. Let's dig into this. No more fucking about. We are going hard into this. So, in 1981, a book called "Who Censored Roger Rabbit" was published, and it was a wee bit darker than this movie. Just a little more adult. A little too adult, and. It was written by Gary K. Wolf, and it's like that exact homage to pulpy 1920s, 30s, 40s, and early 50s drama, like detective drama, overlay with the general cartoon aspect of that era. So not specifically like saying Disney or Warner or any of that, but like Every studio, the whole oeuvre of cartoon characters. And it told a far more adult tale, but Disney, in their heyday of like Tron and the Black Hole, looked at this very dark script and said, "We gots to have that. Sure do.
Oh yeah."
And they bought it. And then held on to it because every time they considered it, they were like, "That sounds like a lot of work. Like, that sounds like a lot. I mean, it's kind of dark, so we have to tone it up. We have to find the right comedic take for it." And at the time, they just wanted to make like an animated movie. Haha, that'd be cool, right? 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 But projects that were inherently more kid friendly and internally driven kept coming up, like, you know, The Great Mouse Detective.
And also, I got to figure there's a simple fact that I'm sure that they looked at this and went, "Okay, we want to do it, but how?"
Yeah, how? I mean, yeah, okay, we do a basic, straightforward animation, but like, that feels like it's kind of missing the point of the spirit of this book. Which is a world, much as you see in the movie, a world in which our world, or at least our world through Hollywood, intersects with a toon world. And there's just natural hegemony there, but also a lot of, like, you know, prejudice and racism, at least in the books. And,
oh, yeah.
And definitely in the movie, too. murder is committed on screen by the bad guy within a minute in front of a bunch of cops.
God.
We'll get to that. We'll get to
that. Oh, yeah.
So at some point, this got into the hands of Robert Zemeckis pretty early on. And, you know, good old Robbie Zemeckis, he'll work a project as long as he needs to until he's satisfied that he can make it zany, stupid, and really, really memorable. Like, a damn fine film. The man make that damn fine film. Let's just say that.
And also, quick note, yes, folks, there was once a time where Robert Zemeckis could do an animated film where every single character did not look like a zombie?
The answer is, don't animate the humans. It's so simple. It's so fucking simple. Anyway, at some point, someone gets this smart-ass idea, because it really is, like, it's the subtext, but God, it's a great text and overtext and in-your-face yeah. text. Why don't we have the animated characters be animated and the human characters and world be, you know, like, just filmed actors on location and sets? And someone went, that is brilliant. Here's only $30 million. See what you can do.
And again, they went, how?
Yeah, and don't get us wrong here. They didn't decide to cheap out. That was a lot of money for an animated film. It's just, this is no longer an animated film. You've made that choice to make a hybrid film at a time when, like, rotoscoping, yeah, we can rotoscope stuff. We can badly animate things onto, like, an actor, like a plate that's been shot with an actor just, like, responding to air and imagining that there's something. But being Disney and visionary fuckwads and such, praise yeah. be to all of them. I'm only entirely jealous of your jobs, you assholes. they wanted to push the limit. So it's like, okay, any asshole can have an actor reacting to nothing and then animate a cartoon in, like, on top of that to react perfectly to the actor. It's what they did all the goddamn time on The Wonderful World of Disney and like Disneyland and all that way back in the 50s and 60s with good old Uncle Walt. It's been done.
Oh, yeah.
What they really wanted was to create a sense of depth, motion, and reality to these characters. So that means shadow, movement, interaction, objects, ramification within their environment, and eyelines, consistent fucking eyelines, which is a fucking hassle.
I want to jump in right here to go to IMDb because there is a note that refers specifically to what you're talking about.
Ooh boy!
When Eddie takes Roger Rabbit into the back room at the bar where Dolores works to cut apart the handcuffs, the lamp from the ceiling is bumped and swinging. Lots of extra work was needed to make the shadows match between the actual room shots and the animation. Today, bump the lamp is a term used by many Disney employees to refer to going that extra mile on an effect just to make it a little more special, even though most audience members will never notice it.
Yeah, there are so many things going on in that one moment that they simply decide to, like, add, if I recall, at the last moment. So, if I recall, Eddie is still handcuffed to Roger, and he pulls him over, and it ends up knocking the lampshade. So the lampshade has to be knocked by something that is not Bob Hoskins or a visible device at the exact yeah. right time that it would look like a body hitting it would. So that's one effect. That's, gee whiz, that's pretty incredible. That's kind of what we saw a little bit of in Escape to Witch Mountain, where it's just like, you put a thing at the end of the string, you have it go bup, 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 bup. Not the most difficult thing. There's an art and finesse to making it look good. Then they add on this lamp is now swaying back and forth. The light source is going in and out and not blinking on and off, to be very clear. It has a wax and a wane on any object that it touches. So that is bright, dark at a consistent pace that your brain knows. So you can't fake it really easily. You can't just be fucking lazy about this. It has to be photo and real life, like, realistic, or else your brain's going to be like, no, 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 and pull attention to it, which it's not supposed to. This is supposed to cover and give realism to it. And it really does. It's just, this is the amount of work that is required for it. So they had to match the shadow on Roger to the actress standing next to his position in terms of its, like, its horizon. And then when she stops the object, they have to then properly shade Roger in absolute shadow while still making it realistic that you can see aspects of his face and reaction. It's, yeah. And that's just 3 seconds, and it's not what you're paying attention to in the scene because they're giving dialogue. There's quality dialogue right there.
Yeah, and this is not static shadow. They have to have, it's got to be moving the entire goddamn time.
Yeah, and like, this is just one example of this. Characters move in and out of foreground.
Yeah.
Outside, inside, from outside to inside. When inside, under different aspects of lamps. Watch next time the penguins in the speakeasy. As they move around the lounge, because there's low light and direct light around the staging and like at certain spots. Plus there is like, there's ambient light, but they all interact with it properly as to not stand out. It's magnificent.
Oh, it really is. And just that bar in general looks lifted out of one of those movies from the 40s.
For a Disney project, that would be pretty goddamn impressive, right?
Oh, yeah.
Pretty goddamn impressive. But you may notice throughout this film, this isn't just Disney characters, even though it's a Disney film. Like, you never see Warner Brothers claim this movie, you know?
I that's true, and I have a theory on why that might be, because Disney fucked with them.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Fuck them.
Well,
fuck
them. Oh, no, specifically in terms of what the Warner Brothers characters would look like.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers wanted them to, like Bugs Bunny, for example. Warner Brothers wanted the modern, like at the time, version of Bugs Bunny to be what was used in the movie. Disney,
yeah,
wanted the 1940s appropriate vintage Bugs Bunny.
Yeah, absolutely. With his rounder head and very specifically in my mind, well, Bugs is of course like distinctly more 1940s. Daffy, that is a beautiful OG generation Daffy Duck who is absolutely bug shit insane. That is the way Daffy should be.
So, yeah. So, like, what Disney did was they did up a bunch of footage that was never, ever going to be used in the movie with the modern version of Bugs. They sent that
all
to Warner
CG
Brothers.
And Space Jammy. And, oh, God, I hate that design.
they sent the version with the modern Bugs Bunny off to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers approved it. And then they put in the footage with the vintage Bugs Bunny into the movie.
And, like, all power to them. They're trying to do immersive storytelling, and it looks better. Like, there's a necessity for it to be on model for the time, because there's social commentary within this movie that black and white characters who did not transition into color have been left behind and turned into second-class citizens within, like, the toon society demographic, what have you. It's fascinating. And you see so few of them very specifically because of that. It's like a social faux pas.
Well, and truly, I think, like, also with Betty Boop, I think it's also there's a degree of commentary on the transition from silent film to the talkies. Because I believe it was pretty much the same thing where you might look great on film, but if you didn't have the voice once sound came in, your career was done.
That as well. Yeah, she does actually, my mistake, she does reference specifically talkies, but she is also the one of the few black and white characters movie. Yeah. So, yeah, double duty for the fact that once color and talkies came in to movies, everything else was dead. Just ask Buster Keaton.
Yeah, I mean, what we're saying is levels.
Sweet, delicious levels. So during one of the legendary stalls over the better part of a decade of this film's production, Michael Eisner reinvigorated it in 1985 by reaching out to his buddies at Amblin. Hey, Steven Spielberg, and got him all hot and bothered about the idea, which is how we ended up getting like these sweet deals with Warner Brothers that otherwise, you know, when hell goes cold, yeah. you bastards, this there are better chances at peace in some war-torn areas of the world than there are to ever see this occur again without Disney just devouring Warner Brothers.
Which, considering A, the way Disney buys up properties, and B, the current state of Warner Brothers, give it time. I mean...
Soon. But yeah, eventually we end up after turmoil, and Terry Gilliam is in this, and go the fuck away. Harrison Ford was almost Eddie Valiant. Like, things are going wrong. Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, stop it. Eddie Murphy, that could have been cool, but no. They finally land on the greatest actor of this or any century to grace the role of Italy's greatest cultural, not export, because they sure as fuck didn't come up with it, Mario himself, Bob Hoskins. Sober this time.
I'm just going to say the irony of the amount Eddie Valiant is drinking on screen, but Bob Hoskins is sober. Whereas Mario Brothers is not drinking at all, but Hoskins is plastered the entire production.
So plastered. We're going to have to do Mario Brothers next horrible tragedy comes out. Yeah. Because, yeah, I've been feeling nostalgic for it. Yeah, that's right. I said that. Nostalgic for the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Oh no! If we're gonna do another drunk show at some point, or well, in my case, a heavily caffeinated show because I can't do funny drunk. But in either case, yeah we gotta do Mario Brothers for that.
Absolutely. There is a world out there where Jack Nicholson was Eddie in this, and like I feel like that would have been almost too perfect. It's one of those things where it's like I have accidentally spoiled myself. I saw something that seemed like it would be perfect, just perfect, and instead I'm now feeling sick, and I think I have to go throw up. Like,
and
potential.
You know what? And Jack Nicholson, there's something there, like, yes, he could have done an amazing job, like, incredible actor, but Bob Hoskins just brought that certain something
that I
don't think Jack would have brought.
Even in Jack's old age, like, you know, all you need to do is look at About Schmidt. He still has an explosiveness, explosive chaoticness to him. that you never know what he'll do. Who the fuck knows? While there's an explosiveness to Bob Hoskins, it's like predictable. He has one reaction. He has two reactions to these things. His first reaction is to drink. But if you persist, he will get angry and like grab your collar and give you a classic 1940s, "Hey, what are you doing, wise guy? I gotta club you from here to St. Louis." You know, it's like, it's predictable, and Bob Hoskins is so good at it because he's a classic actor in that he doesn't look like Hollywood. He doesn't look like he should be doing anything except like playing the Penguin somewhere or being the Penguin somewhere. In fact, are we sure Bob Hoskins was not an international terrorist and or crime lord in his spare time?
I mean,
between parts,
I'm pretty sure if I was to look over his resume, I would find proof that that happened.
Yeah, often. But you know, I mean, not for the paycheck, but for the crime, for the crime.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You also quit something. You can't have the Jack Nicholson explosiveness because the simple fact is Roger is right there. And that's what he's there
Ooh,
for.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. He's far too much of a cartoon himself, whereas no one would ever consider Bob. Like, if there's definitely one problem with the Super Mario Brothers movie, and, you know, that's one problem in a million, it's that they've chosen a Mario who does not, like, should not be in any world except for the real world. He is a man that does not belong in any kind of fantasy. And that's why it works here. Because he's actively like, I don't want to be involved with your plot. I am here to do a completely normal human job of the 1940s for a private detective. Leave me the fuck alone with your weirdness.
Yeah, and
you've got money for booze? Oh.
And also, you had mentioned Harrison Ford, and I can see it, but the problem is the reason that I can see it. Blade Runner wasn't that far in the past. Blade Runner was not that far back.
Oh, I see. I was thinking that, especially because of the use of the Robert Zemeckis mid-80s trumpet, which are akin to the Indiana Jones trumpets. The 80s had a lot of atmospheric trumpets, and I loved how John Williams and Robert Zemeckis, probably hiring John Williams, used it to give like a shrill action movement progression to things. It was great for mystery, it was great for drama, suspense. It was fantastic. And I think that soundscape is actually why, for some reason in my head, I can see Harrison Ford the same way that same soundscape immediately makes sense with Christopher Lloyd. And it's like, it sounds like Back to the Future. So my brain is happy.
No, like that's fair. And like, frankly, as every scene in Eddie's office, as soon as that saxophone hits, I'm literally just going up to the TV, tapping that vein in my arm, like, just mainline it, just right, just get that needle in there, give me this, please.
Oh, it's so good. It's like, I feel like that is the sound of remembering vaguely watching Disney movies as like a child who is so young you don't have any other memories or any proper memory of it, and it's just, yes, I feel like that is a primal fucking memory, and it is such a warm saxophone, but like melancholy. Ah, amazing. That saxophone has an ambient room temperature of like 27 degrees Celsius. Too uncomfortable, but not too hot.
Oh, yeah. And if you put in Harrison Ford as Eddie Valiant, it would still work. He could still absolutely play that same atmosphere, everything.
Yeah.
I just think that would make Eddie less memorable, because what you're essentially getting is 1940s Decker.
Yeah. And that would have been interesting if he's just like super fucking sober or super fucking somber the whole time. Not like sad about the loss of his brother, but like Decker, just, I hate my life.
Yeah.
Like, I never get the feeling Eddie Valiant necessarily hates his life. He longs for the past, but he's still working. He's still trying to get through the day. He's still maintaining, like, the private detective agency and his brother's desk. And he still knows, you know, his friends and connections and all that. He's just decided to drop into a bottle. Decker, I'm always amazed that that movie and book doesn't end with him just killing himself, or even begin that way, because, like, there's nothing that man hates more than, like, existence. And that's it. Like, it's the most depressing Philip K. Dick novel, and that's really saying something.
And but also, like, with Eddie's performance, with Bob Hoskins' performance, there we go. A lot of those office scenes, you have a character drowning in memory, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, and I say this as someone who has seen the movie on multiple occasions, a lot of the scenes where he's reminiscing about his brother is Curse of the Maltese Falcon as hell, and I respect it.
Oh, yes, yeah. There is a Falcon statue, but not the Maltese Falcon statue. Like, they kind of allude instead of overtly showing.
Yeah.
And that's playful and fun. Obviously, this movie was made by, like, some of the biggest Hollywood nerds at the height of their power in the 80s, and it is rife with references. The entire plot itself is only, like, half and somewhat of the aspect of the original book, Who Censored Roger Rabbit? And then they take that basic concept and lurch it on top of Chinatown. and suddenly we get a version of Chinatown we can watch without having to, like, feel morally conflicted about the director.
Oddly enough, now I want to go watch Chinatown.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem.
in my case, it's more Chinatown is on the movies I've never seen list.
Oh, okay. Well, it's fantastic. But now that you have seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit first, you're doomed, because you're going to just keep seeing Who Framed Roger Rabbit in very important moments of this very serious movie. But on the upside, it stars Jack Nicholson, so you get to literally see the movie without any of the animation laid on it. And that's kind of what it is.
And also, like, maybe this. Also, as I'm checking who the director is, yeah, okay, maybe not.
Yeah, there's a reason. Maybe pirate it if you can. Steal that.
Oh,
shit.
That will not be hard.
It's a lesser crime against the criminal. It's fine. but, like, it is unfortunately a fantastic movie. And I wonder if they had not chosen essentially to remake another film, but funny, like, kind of in the style of, and this should be no surprise considering the producer and the original producer of it, Airplane, in which a comedy, a brilliant comedy, offensive now, don't rewatch Airplane unless you're ready to see, like, one racist joke every 3 minutes. Oh, damn.
Historical context, people. Historical context.
Oh my. But it was made by taking a drama, a very serious drama,
yeah,
about exactly what happened in the plot, and a lot of the lines are actually the exact same. Like, any line that isn't an overt joke is exactly the same dialogue as in the original book and movie. I can't remember. It's like Flight something or whatever. It's about a plane and people get sick. And the same as with Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, which is a remake of an incredibly serious nuclear Armageddon thriller. Again, line for line, beat for beat, with only some like embellishment to make it silly, willy, willy, billy, silly. And I wonder if they had not done that for this movie, considering the investment of money and time and technique, if it would have worked, like if they had tried an original script, essentially. Perhaps it required laurels to rest on. So it required the shoulders of giants to reach its own heights. I wonder. I don't know, because I fucking love this movie, but...
You know what? I think it would still work, because that in terms of just like remakes and reboots and such in general, Roger Rabbit gets so many things right that Hollywood today, and it's, let's be honest, hard on for remakes and reboots, absolutely refuses to do. Which is, this just takes just the essence of what it's remaking and builds its own thing from that. It's not, hey, do you remember this, every 5 minutes of screen time.
No, it's just an inhabited world where you can see things, you know, you can see Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny, sure, absolutely, but you know, they're doing their own thing. It has nothing to do with you, and you know, they're gone. The adventure isn't about them, nor necessarily a reference to them. It's just a fun thing you can include. For the most part, other characters they meet throughout this are references in the style of other things. And that allows for the feeling of a larger world, because you know that the thing that they're referencing is out there. But in order for that thing to exist, it must have its own world and like other characters and creatures and such inhabiting it. And so here is a thing of that. Here's a part of that. And like having all of the different variations interact with each other. Like we're talking vast styles. Jessica Rabbit is a form of like a style of animation that started in the 20s and had its real heyday in the 40s, that was often featured in Tijuana Bibles and Blue cartoons, in which women were over the top, ridiculously sexualized, once the war kicked up and, you know, you got troops to entertain and keep motivated. Whereas Roger, of course, is kind of, he's actually less Warner Brothers and Disney. He's kind of an amalgam of that. But I see a lot of Tex Avery. Like, lot of Tex Avery. Who is not as represented in this, but, you know, Roger himself kind of stands in for him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The opening segment that he's filming with Baby Herman. There's a fair bit of Tex Avery, and all Roger almost feels like a mashup of Bugs and Daffy.
Yeah, he's not fully like he has dignity, so he's not fully Daffy Duck.
True.
But he's also an idiot, so he can't be Bugs.
Oh yeah, like. A lot of his dialogue and interaction in the early parts of that are very Bugs, but the running around slapstick is textbook Daffy.
Yeah, while taking a cue from, it's a well-worn trope, you know, the innocent but troublesome ward and the person who has to look after them, who is then troubled and they have to go through shit. But at this time, we would have, or the audience would be familiar, especially the audience in the late 80s, but even the 1940s fictional audience that this would have been like, who would have been watching Roger Rabbit shorts and cartoons in the theaters after Newsreel. Ah, see how the boys are doing at Raw.
And for more modern comparison, for anyone who's familiar with a certain baby simulator where you're trying to keep a, let's be honest, homicidal baby from accidentally killing itself. If you're familiar with that game, but you've ever wanted to see that in 80s animated form, that's pretty much the opening of Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. It's beautifully drawn, and but it's invocative of like Donald Duck having to deal with like Huey, Dewey, and Louie, just like getting in endless fucking trouble, and him racing around a 1940s home. Because there's like an era when he lived in a home with them, and it was a very 1940s home, had 1940s apartments, like appliances and shit like that. You can trace Americana and consumerism from when they used to live in like a suburb with their war vet uncle to a fucking floating castle with their rich other uncle who owns more money than God and super God combined. That's called inflation, kids.
Meanwhile,
there's a bunch
world,
of wonderful tropes.
Meanwhile, in this world, if Donald loses Huey, Dewey, and Louie, or they say get kidnapped, he just calls Eddie and the case gets solved.
Yes, it's a literal newspaper. I've always wanted a copy of that newspaper. I've wanted to go through the newspapers that they created for this movie just to read the lorem ipsum, or hopefully they actually had someone write it. Because there are random like things on the back of those papers. Like there's a scandal mag there. The movie producer, who I can't remember the name of for the life of me right now, is talking to Eddie about getting photographs.
RK
He's
Maroon.
Reading a RK Maroon. I love that name. RK Maroon.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's so good. He's reading an industry rag / a scandal rag, and it's talking about Roger. I believe no. This is after it's talking about Roger having killed Acme. And on the side, it has this really debonair image of Roger, which is a fantastic one if you've never seen it. It's him looking very like 1940s Hollywood A-list Clark Gable, like suave in a suit jacket and shit. I mean, it's clearly like his headshot as an actor. It's beautiful and wonderful. But on the back of that is a silhouette of a duck. And it's very obviously Donald, but these kinds of silhouettes often appeared in scandal rags as "You'll never guess who's gay," and it'd be like really super fucking obvious from the silhouette, but they're not saying it, and they didn't run the image, so hey, you can't us. And that's all I want is just like, is that what it's saying? Is Donald Duck in this universe actually secretly gay? But not like, you know, it's a heartwarming thing, but we're talking Hollywood blacklisting. Charlton Heston and John Wayne come after Donald Duck in the early 1950s and throw him before the House American Un-American Activities Committee. I need answers. Did Ronald Reagan fuck over Donald Duck?
Okay, you remember what's his name? Pete, the kind of bear wolf-esque creature who is usually like Goofy's bully.
Yeah, Peg Leg Pete. until he's no longer peg leg.
There's your Charlton Heston.
Oh my God, he would too.
Exactly. Like we could we could build this sequel that would become the single darkest thing Disney has ever even considered.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Pete and the original Maleficent power couple of LA. Once they get to Sacramento, watch your ass, gays.
Oh, it's disturbing that I want this movie. I'm sorry. Forget Chip and Dale as the spiritual sequel to Roger Rabbit. Give me this.
That's why I always liked what was the show Bonkers, because it felt like it was a sequel to this most directly.
Yeah,
like he was a cop in L.A. from Toontown. Like all I ever wanted was more direct of this. Not to say I want sequels of this. This should never get a sequel or a remake. We are too far gone for a sequel and a remake, and you're just gonna fuck it up. You're gonna make it like, I like that in Chip and Dale they went half hand drawn, and that wasn't actually hand drawn, that was done on a computer, but
yeah.
The style of it is quote unquote hand drawn. That's the filter on Photoshop, hand drawn, TM.
Quick side note, for Chip and Dale they did have the decency to bring Charles Fleischer back to play Roger Rabbit.
Thank God. Thank God. I mean, like, you gotta do something right. Charles Fleischer, a guy who on like visual, I always think is Rich Little, or Rich Hill, who is the basis for Mo Sizlak. Anyway.
Well, and also, you know what? Quite frankly, a lot of his live action roles are in horror movies. Look at his IMDb picture and you will see why.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a look that doesn't match Roger's face.
He's got a look that would give Roger nightmares.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of like famous people playing, Kathleen Turner was unaccredited for the voice of Jessica Rabbit, even though it's really fucking obvious.
Right?
Really fucking obvious. And I've never really understood that decision. I understand it on academic level why they kind of fucked her on that one. I understand that someone did that, but I don't agree with it to the level of why. It's obvious. Why? She's great. Why? Like, that's a fantastic performance that could have been so badly done, so two-dimensional. Instead, they make Jessica, like, complicated and complex. And, like, slightly villainous, but also, like, she's not fully, like, action heroine capable or anything, but she's not a damsel.
No.
And Eddie makes that mistake a couple of times. And it bites him in the ass, and at one point he almost falls to his death because of it. She's more than capable. Don't be fooled, or she'll slap you. Slap you. But it's a fantastic performance, and it's really fascinating to look back and see, like, wow, Warner Brothers really did steal the design for the last like 30 years of Poison Ivy. Just from this one movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I don't blame them. One performance that we haven't brought up yet at all, which is, well two. I'll start with the small one first, which is Joanna Cassidy's Dolores. On the one hand.
She's really good. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. On the one hand, does she get a lot to do? No, not really. On the other hand, is this woman playing the standard 40s detective's secretary slash friend slash let's be honest, 1940s American money penny to perfection.
Oh,
hell yes.
To perfection. She's the right level of like detailed backstory interaction with him without it becoming like too much in a way that harms either of the characters. She keeps a sense of mystery without being mysterious. She has she's doing her own thing, and he's just like, she's having to deal with him stumble bumming around. Yeah. She's capable and clearly like relatively, she's better off financially than Eddie is. Let's just say that. She owns a camera and he's a private detective. He doesn't own a fucking camera. He has to borrow it from her, and she helps him run a shadow tab to pay for his fucking work through the bar.
Oh my god. Yeah, she is like, she's basically like the proverbial Girl Friday and just has it down to a science.
Yeah, she's not a character so much as she is a part of the machine of the story. Yeah, she's a mechanic of the story, which is a shame because all I want is more of her and Eddie's story and his late brother, because they seem to have had fun and I want to hear their adventures. I'm kind of surprised that in the early 90s they didn't do a Valiant and Valiant Detective Brothers series that would have just been like a couple of years of live action super cheaper version of Roger Rabbit. Like, the interactions wouldn't have been as clean, the eyelines not as well done, but you know, Disney Channel live action, half an hour, do it in the style of young Indiana Jones adventures.
I mean, and just for Bob Hoskins' performance, I lamented the fact that we didn't get two things, which, number one, like as you more or less said, an Eddie Valiant spinoff. I would have watched the hell out of that. And number two, and the only way that I can think of that this film could have gotten more perfectly 40s noir, Eddie narrating.
Ooh, yeah. And being unreliable because, for the first half of the story at least, because he's drunk.
Yeah.
Like, push it that extra mile of like, no, you're a bad detective and narrator. Get better so that you can solve the story and tell it. Ooh. There's a part of me that wants to see this overlap with Hollywoodland. And he has to solve the murder and doesn't solve the case of what happened to Fleischer's Superman after, like, Fleischer's Superman is discovered dead at a party.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, that, oh, that would be perfect, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. I just came up with that patent pending.
Well, God, I mean,
damn it. Sadly, I always give it away.
Yeah, well, patent or not, sadly, we can't do it because nobody who is not Bob Hoskins touches Eddie Valiant. I don't care how good the actor is.
Very, very.
No.
True. And, yeah. You can do pastiches, you can do copies, but it's not never going to be Bob Hoskins, Eddie Valiant. Oh my God. So good. Such a great performance.
And I did say there were two actors that we hadn't mentioned at all yet. And speaking of great performance, the other actor, Christopher Lloyd.
Ah, so good. So good. So Tim Curry almost had that spot. And that would have been fun. That would have been great.
Oh, yeah.
Fun, great Disney fun. But Christopher Lloyd was having a great decade. Like, he does three amazing performances in this decade, and they're all over the top in their own way. Of course, you know, there's his Klingon commander from Search for Spock, which is like the first time you get to see Christopher Lloyd as a villain, and you're like, this is weird, but I kind of like it. It kind of works. I like this. It's scaring me a little.
Krooge was very much a generic character that would only work because it was Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah. The extra oomph he puts into reading a line just makes everything so good. I love that. Kill one of them. I don't care which. Just the actual, you can feel, I really, truly don't give a fuck.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Don't bother me. It's incredible. Then, of course, Doc Brown, the character that probably defined his entire career.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. And for good reason. Lovable, chaotic, insane. A character that could become a villain, but just never tips over. Definitely does things that's like, dude, supervillains do that. And he's like, yeah, but it's for science. Okay.
The man got plutonium from Libyan terrorists, but is not a villain.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Not a terrorist. Only does business with terrorists. Is not plotting anything in downtown Hill Valley, officer. Please do not inspect my equipment. Not a terrorist. Blew up a train after stealing it. Not a terrorist. Scientist.
Well, I mean, he did blow up that train in I believe the 1890s, at which point hijacking wasn't what it is today, let's say.
Not a terrorist. Only almost caused the collapse of the space-time continuity a few times. Not a terrorist.
No.
Anyway.
No.
But in the middle of his Doc Brown oeuvre, we get this wonderful character, Judge Doom. And I've always loved Judge Doom, and I was always kind of annoyed that he wasn't a more interesting character, like, under the character.
Well, Doom is also, he's very much the cog of a 40s detective story. In that you need that bad guy who, in the final plot twist, also just happens to be the bad guy that your detective has been pursuing for basically his entire career.
Yeah. And like, it's a brilliant setup, and then to have it twist around by being like, oh, but he's managed to like double back on him. And now he's this, like, he's a higher authority in the law and higher standing in the community than our hero. And his word is like law. Like, he literally kills an innocent character. And like, if tunes are conscious and like people and all that, then that tune shoe that he kills is a fully conscious person. Like tunes all have to be considered like one species, because they are tunes. Like, a tree can have a consciousness just as much as a dog can have a consciousness. Therefore, any difference cannot be taken. You have to give them all carte blanche rights. And so he, in front of a bunch of cops, murders an innocent person, and no one says anything about it. They're all too afraid. That speaks volumes. He's an institutional kind of violence that immediately cuts right to it, due to a prejudice, seemingly, like, you know, you only find out later that he is a toon himself, and this whole thing is like just using prejudice to get away with whatever he wants and be a bastard.
Yeah.
But it's so writ large about racism, and yet not at all. Or at least bigotry of some sort. And yet not at all. You don't, it doesn't like go, it doesn't wait for you to notice.
Yeah, no, and like that's the thing. He goes from terrifying, subdued stoicism to quite literal cartoon supervillainy on a dime. And he's somehow going all out with both versions of the character. And it's, frankly, it's a flawless performance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it's brilliant. Baron von Rotten was apparently the character, though that was a retcon, it seems. And Baron von Rotten is like a generic reference to some of the early black and white Disney and Max Fletcher and Tex Avery, villains who would be just bad guys in hoods, generic like dark lords. Like Disney characters. Mickey Mouse used to fight like dark lords and shit. It was weird. There was a lot of horror and death imagery in those black and white cartoons, the Merry Melodies and shit.
Oh, yeah.
And so that comes through in this character who's just like fucking ruthless. And he's got the weasels. Hey, weasels. His own personal Gestapo. But yeah, everyone in this is fantastic, and it aged, even the animation aged super well.
It really did, yeah.
The characters aged super well, you know, and I think that's because, of course, they're already placed back in a history and a perspective where anything that would arise as old-fashioned can just be, like, pointed at and like, yeah, they're in the past. You know, that used to happen in medieval times. So it's okay when Game of Thrones does it. It's fine.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. And if you've never seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit for some reason, I honestly don't know how the fuck you're living. Why? What kind of existential hell is that to exist in? Why would you do this to yourself?
Yeah, no, like, if you're an animation fan of any kind, this, you need to watch this. Like, hell, if 40s film noir and detective stories are your thing, you need to watch this. Because one thing I didn't get the chance to mention earlier was just the camera work in that back room.
The camera,
or in Eddie's office.
Beautiful.
My God. You could watch those scenes in black and white or splice them into an actual 40s detective film and they would look right at home.
And like that's a testament to the true capabilities here, because again, it's not that they're just making a noir film. Sure, you can do that, reproduce the shots, all that. You're then adding on the technique of all of this as real to real life as possible cartoon animation overlaid into it. And it's like there are shots that could have made it easier to do those techniques. There are shots that it would have made it harder to do those techniques. So maybe you don't do those shots or those techniques. No, instead they double down. They, as you said, you know, they knock the lamp or they push the lamp or whatever. And every time it's, what's the hardest way we could do this that creates the best outcome? And we will do that.
Yeah, I mean, quite simply, I know you're not listening, but I'm going to say this anyway. Hollywood, when you're doing remakes, it's not do what they did. It's do it how they did it.
How? We want to see the same kind of sausage, not eat the same fucking sausage. That's gross. It's been years. I don't care if it's been in the freezer.
Yeah, no, it's like I said with Escape to Witch Mountain and earlier in this episode, actually, just the essence, the substance.
The stop feeling, photocopying not the form.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that is why this movie must never be allowed to be remade or sequelized ever. It would be made lesser. I know, like, you know, you can always, like, ignore sequels, or sequels will happen and such, and all that. But honestly, this is a diamond in the rough. Stop making cubic zirconia and trying to swap out the diamond. It's let it be a diamond.
Yeah, I mean, if we have learned anything from Thor Ragnarok and Thor Love and Thunder, your sequel expectations will be set far too high, and that sequel is not going to hit them.
Yeah, and you're just not going to have fun. You're just not going to have any fun.
Not every second film can be Wrath of Goddamn Khan.
Sometimes it turns out to be Into Darkness.
Oh, sad but so very true, and fuck that movie.
Fuck that movie indeed. So, what are we watching next time?
Well, we'll be wrapping up our live-action Disney month. And, well, let's be honest, thanks to the hurricane month and a half. Live-action Disney films from our childhood. With another one of those, how have I not gone back to this sooner? With 1986's Flight of the Navigator.
Yay! It's a really confusing movie. I remember watching it when I was 3 and not getting it.
It's... Do you like Knight Rider? Do you like Star Trek? Would you like a movie that takes those basic concepts, squishes them together, and hands that technology to a kid?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go watch a movie that's going to fire off a lot of really, really, really primordial memories for me that I have no context for. Hooray!
So this is going to be amazing. And then we're going to continue the no context as we finally get into our Halloween themed, where I will be taking my first ever foray into body horror. Well, okay, Videodromes. We did do Videodromes, I guess. Technically second foray, or like first and a half, or look, however you want to count it.
It's fair to call Videodrome body horror, but what you're going to watch is, it's master's level to Videodrome's high school introductory class. This is gonna hurt you.
Oh no. Expect me to be mentally and emotionally broken by this time in November. So, ironically, I will be a shell of a human being just in time for Black Panther.
Which should refill you with glory and joy. And if you, too, are a shell of a human being, please like, share, subscribe, leave a comment, and possibly send an email. Reach out to Mike. He is struggling. He's struggling. He needs your help.
So you can send us your questions, comments, compliments, criticisms, therapist recommendations to... Let's be honest. To realgeekshfx@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at realgeekshfx. You can find me at the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, or themaritimelord@gmail.com. And Crash.
And I am on Twitter at Friday in Halifax and Crash and Burn everywhere else. Until next time, please go away.
Nice.